If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Will Weber is on the board. Will Erskine booking the guests. In the newsroom, Diana Weeks and Dave Woodard. Here's Scott Thompson.
Someone forgot to do their homework last night. Can we play anything faster, Will? Good afternoon. It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson. The gang's all here. Feel free to jump into the fun. We would love to hear from you. Send us a note, Scott Thompson at 900 CHML. Huh?
I can't hear you.
Send us a note, Scott Thompson at 900CHML.com. All right, a typical news day, but you know, an incredible weekend in the Hammer. So let's bring in a couple of super crawlers who, the two Wells. Not only do they work together, they also play together. Will Weber and Will Erskine with us now. And what did you guys do down at Supercrawl? You were working together on something?
Yeah, we were both. I ended up recruiting Will Weber into this. Local artist and friend of mine, Jennifer Coy, was one of the theatrical productions at Supercrawl. So we had a short 30-minute show that was staged three times just off of Mulberry Street. And I kind of was producer for that as well, and Will Weber was the sound and tech guy. So it was just what we do with you, Scott, but we did it for a stage production that was happening on the sidewalk with a ton of glitter being thrown at the audience.
An irresponsible amount of glitter, I would say.
An irresponsible.
That's how I have a fun weekend.
So, wow, what a cool, explain what it was, explain what we would have seen if we were there. What was it about?
Yeah, sure. So what it was, again, my friend Jennifer Coy, local artist, absolutely loves this city, and loves the art crawl. So, which, you know, for anyone who's coming to Supercrawl, and maybe even from outside the city, it can be great to find out that we actually have this thing on the second Friday of every month.
Yeah,
we have
every
an
month,
event.
Yeah,
yeah right yeah. there on James, where you get all the artists lined up, just bringing out their stuff. There's some people who just bring out things. They're not even selling it. They're just like, hey, want to see some cool stuff I made? So it's a different experience than the Supercrawl. So my friend wanted to do something that kind of aggrandized that, showed that off, and told people about it, but in a really, really fun, ridiculous, over-the-top way. She likes science fiction. She likes 80s action films. So kind of did this sort of parody of Terminator and all those sorts of vibes. So it's about two people who have time traveled back to warn everyone that, hey, in the future, the art crawl's been canceled, all right? And it's been taken away by like the forces of boredom. So they're trying to warn everyone at the Super Crawl. You got to make sure you have fun in life. You got to make sure you party and have a great time. And then the fun police show up from the future to stop that. And
wow.
Yeah. And
this is all happening. This is just one of the side productions off to the side.
This is
typical of Supercrawl.
This is typical.
Yeah.
Exactly. Down the street, just down the street from us, there were these, another group who had this performance going with these like 20-foot tall puppeted giant purple hands.
Squonk. Gotta love the squonk.
Yeah, that was their group. And you know, you go around there. We were right across from an installation piece that was like this post-apocalyptic beehive farm happening, and there was like smoke blowing over from it. I mean, that's what you know. Supercrawl is just taking what's awesome about art crawl. And
so
then,
what did Weber say about too much of what at the beginning?
An irresponsible amount of confetti and glitter.
An irresponsible, so, yeah.
So was there cleanup after the show?
There was.
The kids loved the show. By the way, it was great. They loved just taking handfuls of the stuff away, which made the sweeping a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Well, you know, anytime you're going to go and make a mess, chances are you're going to have a good show on your hands.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Not the philosophy of life right there, Scott?
That's right. Go in and bring as much confetti as you can.
Right.
So give us a rundown. So you guys were participating in some of the events. That's great. Good for you. So give us just a general overview of what the weekend was like, what you saw, your impression of it. Obviously, lots of people.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, no, it was awesome to see the crowds, especially, you know, when it starts warming up. I always kind of forget that it takes a little bit for Supercrawl to get going. You get the people hesitantly showing up there, and they're coming in from all the different angles of the street, and they're picking out their food trucks. They're planning out what they're going to eat throughout the day, and they're finding the finding the different stages. And then by the end of the night, it's absolutely jam packed. Yeah. It's a party. You know, Dirty Nil on Friday night was wild. I saw pictures. One of my friends did, I think, one of the coolest things that you can do at Supercrawl when they get their rock bands going is you can end up crowd surfing James Street.
Yeah.
One of my buddies.
Yeah. Is there protective headgear for that? I mean, you know, you should, if you're cycling with a helmet,
you should
be wearing your bike helmet when you're crowd surfing.
Exactly. Let's be responsible, people. So it fills up with all sorts of people coming out just to have fun. Just to mill around again near some food trucks or some of the art installations, just see each other and catch up. So that was the whole weekend. As I was telling you earlier on the phone, Scott, Sunday I was walking by and I just happened to catch Dave Rave take the stage and sing Picture My Face. It was so cool. And it was a total fluke. I hadn't looked at the schedule. I was just moving along. I just bought a present for a friend from one of the local artisans who had a little tent there, and then I start hearing, you know, them say, "And here, you guys know him, it's Dave Rave," and I just booked it down the street. It was so awesome. It was so alive and fun, and I'm really looking forward to the next art crawl as well, just to keep this energy rolling. Weber, how about you?
My general impression of the super crawl was, look at this big group of people I'm going to be annoying, because I was running around with a megaphone advertising the show, just running around. Denizens of the art crawl, you have a chance to be part of super crawl history here.
Oh man, that's great. Well, that's the spirit, man. That's what it's about. That's how it started. That's what it's blown up into. So all in all, the return of Supercrawl, two thumbs up. More people than last, or how would you measure crowds?
I would say maybe slightly less than the last full Supercrawl I went to in 2019. Probably people still a little bit, I don't know, hesitant, but it was a pretty substantial amount of people coming out. So it was
all
a
right.
good time.
The two wills at Supercrawl this past weekend.
The latest attack happened at a retirement home on New Street on Saturday morning when a coyote attacked a woman who had fallen asleep on the patio. She was briefly hospitalized but was back home as of Sunday. Mayor Marianne Mead Ward says Burlington's crisis management team has been activated and that she's spoken with the Minister of Natural Resources and Forestry about the recent unprovoked attacks, including one on a toddler. City staff announced last month that they were stepping up a campaign urging residents to report any coyotes they see, and a warning of a $300 bylaw fine for anyone hand-feeding or ground-feeding wildlife on private or public property. Lisa Pileski, 900 CHML News.
Wow, that's getting scary when, you're lying there and all of a sudden an animal approaches you. Let's bring in Marianne Mead Ward, Mayor, City of Burlington, and is with us now. Marianne, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
I am. Thanks for your interest.
Boy, this has gone up another notch, it seems, again. Any idea how many animals may be involved in some of these sightings or attacks, or if it is the same one that is doing this or that has slipped away? What more can you tell us there?
Well, we have had great support and advice from the ministry, right from the minister all the way through to his staff of experts. So what they have told us, based on what we know from the attacks and from talking to the victims, is that this is probably the work of a family of coyotes. They are territorial. One family can take up as much as a 15-kilometer radius, and all of the attacks have occurred well within that. So the first three, we were able to identify and euthanize that coyote, but there are other members of that same family that we are now tracking with the help of ministry staff. We have a certified wildlife technician, of course, our animal control, and we really do rely on the public to call in any sightings. That helps us a lot.
That's my next question. How do you track? How does that work? And is that obviously depending on who sights and calls in?
So they are territorial, so they do stay, one family will take up a whole area. So this is really, I think, the good news for the community, that it is isolated to a small group of coyotes that we will find. Our staff have been tracking them. There have been a number of sightings. And so once we, our protocol at the city, our longstanding protocol has been, as soon as a coyote attacks a human, they're a threat, obviously, and they have to be eliminated. So we will be tracking this family and eliminating them.
So any idea of numbers here, Marianne? How many in this pack?
We don't know that. We don't know the answer to that yet. Yeah.
So you've activated a crisis management team. What does that mean?
That means we bring all of the department heads together that need to be involved in the conversation. I just got off the call with them now. It's a much more formal structure. We were meeting informally when the first three attacks occurred as an emergency team to track and deal with that coyote, which we did. We thought that was the end of it. Then two more attacks occurred. Our staff were tracking that animal when the third attack on Saturday occurred. And so the crisis management team is a more formal process. We liaise directly with the province on it. It is one step below a state of emergency. So it's a serious situation. It puts some structure and formality around making sure that all the department heads who need to be part of this conversation are there, and that we are in close contact with the province to get advice on how to deal with this.
And what is Natural Resources' role in this at this point?
They are providing invaluable expertise to us. They are experts in wildlife management in general and coyote behavior in particular, and it was through those conversations that we learned about the fact that this was probably a single family, that they are up to a 15-kilometer radius, that once we eliminate and deal with that family, then these attacks will stop. The other thing, though, that is critically important is that they suggested the behavior was probably because they've lost their fear of humans, probably because somebody is feeding them, either intentionally or not. And I was sent this morning pictures of somebody who left a bushel of corn beside a bike path this morning, less than a half a block from where this lady was attacked on Saturday. That has got to stop.
Yeah, it's bizarre that, you know, even though this sort of stuff goes on, because I've seen it just in, you know, somebody taking bones out. It's like, you can't do that. You just can't do that. Any idea how many encounters there have been so far?
Well, there have been a lot of sightings, and we do ask people anytime they see a coyote to report that. They can call City Hall's main number, or there is an online reporting tool, because we do use that information to figure out how many coyotes there are in Burlington, where they're located, where their movements are. That's really helpful. Some folks have taken cell phone video and sent it in, which is also helpful to identify coyotes, but we really do rely on the public to report that to us. And if you see illegal storage of food or food out in garbage cans, or like this morning, the bushel of corn, please let us know, because we will deal with that immediately. And continue to send the message. You know, people may feel that they're being well-meaning by feeding wildlife. They're actually signing their death warrant.
Yeah,
as soon as an animal becomes accustomed to humans, they're a threat to humans.
Good point. Marianne Mead Ward with us, Mayor, City of Burlington, as they continue to deal with their coyote situation. And if you see one, give the town a call so they can keep up to date with all of this. Good luck with this, Mayor, moving forward. Be well.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the interest.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Well, isn't this going to be a fascinating race? We've got the extreme populist leader on the left making fun of the extreme populist leader on the right. And somewhere in the middle is the rest of Canada. Let's bring in Tom Korski, current managing editor of Blacklock's Reporter in Ottawa, and is with us now. Tom, thank you for your time. I hope you're well.
No complaints. Thank you, Scott.
Your thoughts on Pierre Poilievre getting securing, obviously, the leadership? I guess no surprise there. But are you surprised at the reaction so far from various leaders?
No, I think the House is going to be a box of fireworks when it comes back into session. You know what's striking, Scott? And this is really remarkable, is some of the data from the fundraising that was done by all party candidates. You look at Polyev's numbers. He raised $4.6 million in his leadership drive from almost 39,000 contributors. By the way, that doesn't mean two or three oil companies chip in a fortune. It's mandated, it's a felony if you donate more than $1,600. These are all mom-and-pop donations. Over $4.5 million from 39,000 contributors. That's something, Scott. And in this town, people pay attention to that because that means you have something that looks like a little machine, and that inspires some focus on your adversaries. That's big money in Canada.
Who is buying in then, Tom? Can you write this all off to the Freedom Convoyers?
Well, that's a lot of Freedom Convoy supporters, as they were for the Freedom Convoy, right? They raised twice, what was it, over $20 million before the funds were unfortunately frozen by various courts and cabinet orders. But that's right across the country. When you have that kind of money, it says two things to your opponents. It says, number one, that you are making people feel good, and they feel so good that they want to give you $20 in the middle of inflation. It also says that you have the mechanism through the internet to get that $20. And Polyev has that going for himself. To draw the comparison, admittedly, there's been passage of time, Scott. This is more than twice what Trudeau raised when he won the leadership of his party in 2013. More than double, not even close.
So that being said, can the Liberals continue to paint him as an extremist, as a populist right winger? Are they going to have to do more than that to defeat him?
No, sure, they can paint him any way they like. Polyev has an unusual quality. We've noticed this over the years, especially, doesn't get a lot of attention, but we always covered this like the moon landing, and that's committee hearings. Polyev is a combative guy. He reminds me of the Ottawa Hockey Senators. Used to have a winger, Chris Neal. Every club has a guy like this. And when the team was down, Neal would go on the ice, head straight for the assistant captain of the opposing team, give him a face wash. The crowd would get very upset. Everyone, he was the spark plug that got them going. And that's Polyev. He's a very galvanizing, divisive figure. Call him names if you choose. It will not do you any good.
Will Justin Trudeau run against him in the next election, or do you think we'll see a new leader by then?
Isn't it interesting that there are three parties that have some deep soul searching, and the Conservatives have now gone through it one more time, picked a leader? You are absolutely right, Scott. It implied a question. For Liberals and you Democrats, what you see is what you get. You know that you do not have the material to win a majority. Do you plan to do something about it? Everyone was diminished in the last campaign. I know there was a winner, but everyone was diminished. No one got what they wanted. Conservatives decided to change the deck. We'll see what the others do.
Election sooner rather than later. Many have said that neither the parties are in a good spot to be fighting an election within the next year. I'm not sure about this. Could this happen sooner rather than later?
I think there's going to be such pressure. That's really Jagmeet Singh's call, isn't it? There's going to be such pressure, though, because you will get the sense that when the House comes back, when I say box of fireworks, I mean, you can forget about building back better. They're going to be at each other's throats, Scott. And it's going to be like that for the next 3 years if they decide to run the table. That's a lot of pressure. And in the meantime, Conservatives know this. You ask any conservative, they'll tell you the Liberals went through this to their grief 15 years ago. They lost 2015, 2019, 2021. You cannot lose four in a row and be a national party. Conservatives feel that pressure. It's going to be absolutely fascinating, Scott.
Many are painting Polyev as the extremist on the right, yet we have Justin Trudeau and Jagmeet Singh forming a coalition, many would say, on the extreme left. Where is Jagmeet Singh in all of this? What kind of trigger is he?
He made a play. I don't want to be unfair to the man, but he made a play that you wouldn't do if you were good at playing cards. And that is when you signed a blank check to pass every confidence and budget bill for the next 3 years in exchange for. because you are now tying your fortunes to a federal prime minister who does have a disapproval rating of 52%. You know, Polyev's not the only galvanizing divisive guy. The prime minister is too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you see where I'm going with this, Scott. Instead of taking it piece by piece, you know that anything can change in a month, and it always does. And that was an odd play for Singh to make. It'll be interesting to see if he sticks with it.
Obviously, hinging on dental care, he's made that demand known. Can he or will he trigger an election he knows he can't win?
Well, he lost seats in the last two run-up, and his own brother was defeated in Brampton in the provincial vote. So you can say, I'm not going to win the next election. Or conversely, you can say, how much do I stand to lose? The more that time goes by, and time is one cruel mistress, my friend, in politics.
What kind of leader will Pierre Poilievre be? Will he run the same sort of campaign in a general election that he did in the leadership race? Many are questioning that.
It's hard to say, but you know, there is an unknowable, and it's an intriguing unknowable, and that is, what kind of a leader is he inside caucus? That's a secret. No one ever really knows. They used to say about Harper that Harper was actually a very warm, collegial man in caucus. You would not know that unless you were a member of his caucus. I have heard caucus members say that he would put up with sharp criticism inside caucus. He would never stand in the general public, and everyone else saw Snarly Steve. That became legendary. What kind of leader is Poilievre inside caucus? Why does that matter? Because there are caucus members who have said in the last two elections to their defeated leaders, I did my job, you did not do yours. And that's why they're on leader number three for the fourth time now since 2015. That really matters.
Tom Korski with us, managing editor, BlackLock's reporter in Ottawa. Tom, thanks so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you, Scott.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk 900 CHML.
Boy, I remember in the anniversaries or as the day passed years after 9/11, especially the first anniversary or such, and then second and then fifth. And, you know, people were a little anxious, a little concerned. And now here we are yesterday, 21st anniversary of 9/11. Are we still in the same place? Let's bring in Elliot Tepper, Emeritus Professor of Political Science, Carleton University, with us now. Elliot, thank you for your time. I hope you're well.
Thank you. Same to you, Scott.
After 21 years, have we forgot the impact that this has had, or is it still something that's there?
Well, it's definitely something that's still there. I think one of the big questions underlying what you're asking there is, why wasn't there more of a big deal made out of the 21st? Perhaps the 20th anniversary was more widely noted. I think it's probably a combination of things. First of all, we've had a lot of success in terms of combating that type of extremism, that kind of terror. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, it was also a bit of a tainted response. So one reason I think we are dealing with, why isn't there more being made out of this? We should remind ourselves, perhaps just go online and take a look at some of the images from that day and look at the figures, how many were killed and so forth. But there's been a lot of success in combating international terrorism, especially Al-Qaeda, the planner. Keep in mind, it was only, August 2nd, just a month ago or so, when a drone killed one of the key plotters, Ayman al-Zawahiri, was killed by a drone attack inside where? Afghanistan. But that means that he's not the only leading figure. His predecessor was killed. We had ISIS looming as a giant concern, and now it's gone, reduced in any event. It's not top of the mind anymore due to the success in dealing with international terrorism that can strike the homeland.
Expand on how the discussion changed amongst allies after this, because, you know, nobody could ever imagine this could possibly happen. And, you know, I remember that discussion happening after the event. How did it change the politics? How did it change how the allies react and focus on what a problem this was?
The phrase at the time is that the world had changed.
Yeah.
What wasn't as clear at the time is, well, certainly the U.S. has changed. Had the world changed along with it? The global war on terror, GWAT, at the time, clearly was an international phenomenon. It felt like not just the U.S., and certainly Canada felt this most pressingly as a neighbor, you know, come from away, and we can talk about Gander and so forth. But yes, there was a global war on terror. It mobilized international coalition. The attack on the Taliban, which followed, it successfully dislodged them from power. It didn't complete the job, as it turns out. But quite clearly, the U.S. changed the alliance globally, the focus of world, the coalition, certainly of Western powers, those countries that shared America's values, that would be our values as well. That was a real success story. Unfortunately, in doing so, the mobilization inside Afghanistan was of some of the most retrograde elements in Afghanistan, and the collapse of Afghanistan internally afterwards has followed. But also, one of the things I think that has followed after that initial success was there's kind of a taint on the global war on terror. Guantanamo, after all, is still in existence. There are people arrested 21 years ago who still have not been charged. There was Abu Ghraib, there was rendition. There was a dark side to the global war on terror that I think has tainted some of the success story of the day.
We remember it wasn't that long ago when troops were pulling out of Afghanistan. Is that threat still there?
We know it's still there because the Taliban were sheltering Al-Qaeda after pledging, oh, no, we will never do that again. So you can trust us. So you can leave. All we wanted was you guys should get out of our country. Once you're gone, we're going to look after our country. We will behave. We will work with the opposition.
Are they becoming as organized, Elliot, where they could possibly do something like this again?
Well, the point of why we aren't paying more attention to it right now is the success in seeing to it that that has not been the case. There is concern. I mean, one other factor in all this is while the apparent threat from international terrorism and attacking the North American homeland seems to have receded, there's also simultaneously been a risk of domestic extremism, and that has replaced the focus. So a lot of the focus now is, after January 6th in particular, is the rise of domestic homegrown extremism. I am concerned, and you've raised it very well, Scott, that we may be taking our eye off the ball, that the possibility is that there will be a regrouping. Certainly ISIS is regrouping. We cannot forget that 9/11 did happen. And remember the slogan, the solemn ceremonies with family members reading out names of those almost 3,000 people killed, including 24 Canadians, is never forget. Perhaps we had better be reminded of that on this anniversary, the 21st anniversary of 9/11.
Well said, Elliot Tepper, Emeritus Professor of Political Science, Carleton University. Yesterday, 21st anniversary of 9/11. Elliot, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
And thank you. Same to you, Scott.
We all know what it's been like the last 2.5 years with a global pandemic and trying to get vaccines. And then once we get a vaccine, trying to get it in our arms and such. Well, now Ontario is rolling out the new Omicron-targeted COVID-19 vaccine, starting with residents considered the most vulnerable, including those 70 and older, long-term care and healthcare workers, etc. Monday, as of today, appointments are available to get. Let's bring in Brendan Liu, Hamilton Public Health Services resident doctor, and with us now. Brendan, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Yes, thank you for having me so much, Scott, and hope you're well as well.
So far, so good, Brendan. So talk about, this is the new one that is specifically designed to target the Omicron variant. Who should be getting this now? And another question, how long do we wait between one dose to getting this one? How long should that period be?
Those are some really great questions. And so we are very excited at Hamilton Public Health Services to be rolling out this bivalent Omicron targeted vaccine campaign and starting with our individuals in our community who are at the highest risk. And so starting from today, we have plenty of appointments available for the bivalent vaccine for those who are living in long-term care homes, retirement homes, elder care lodges, and any other sort of congregate living settings. And also for our community members who are over the age of 70, those who are immunocompromised over the age of 12, those who are First Nations, Inuit, or Métis over the age of 18, as well as those who are healthcare workers or pregnant over the age of 18. And those individuals can go onto our website today and book their vaccine appointment.
And we all know that you could go on through the websites as you're speaking of and book appointments, could also do it through pharmacies back in the day. Is that still going on, or is that option still available?
Absolutely. So we're really partnering with our pharmacy colleagues in the community to make sure that this vaccine is available to those in the community who it's recommended for and who are eligible for it. And so I encourage folks to jump on the City of Hamilton vaccination website or the Ontario government website for a list of pharmacies that where they might be able to head to get their vaccine.
And what about how long between doses and or if you've had it, if you've come down with it, how long do you wait?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And so we are really strongly recommending people who it has been 6 months since they have either had a COVID infection or since their most recent vaccine dose, that this vaccine is definitely recommended for those folks. However, it can also be offered for as soon as 3 months since your most recent infection most recent dose of the vaccine.
There has been, some have been saying there's been conflicting information about how long you should wait, but really, I guess that depends on your situation and how vulnerable you are.
Yes, and we know that over time, our body does develop the antibodies that help to protect us from COVID and this most recent Omicron variant. And the most recent dose of your vaccine, as well as an infection from COVID, can provide some protection. But particularly for those who it's been 6 months since you've had that exposure, we're really strongly recommending those folks to get in for their next dose of their vaccine.
So are you expecting people to jump on board? Because obviously we had a massive uptake on this, huge, you know, many people jumping on board and getting vaccinated. Are you expecting the same thing with this booster? Is that needed as much? What are you saying to residents in regard to getting that shot?
Yeah, so we're definitely partnering with our partners, including pharmacy, as well as our healthcare workers in the community to make sure that we have capacity to deliver vaccine, this bivalent vaccine to all of those in the community, who are particularly those at the highest risk, and then out to the more general population. And so we're really encouraging folks that as we get into the fall and winter, folks are moving inside, spending more time in close quarters, and kids are back in school, that there's definitely going to be an increased risk from COVID, as well as our other respiratory viruses, such as influenza in our community. And so we really want to make sure that particularly those at the highest risk have the most up-to-date protection that they can against COVID-19.
We all know when the kids get back to school in September and October, when people slowly go inside, that everything kind of picks up, whether it's the flu, the cold, or even COVID-19. What about the younger ages? Should they be getting this as well? Will this eventually move down 60, 50, 40, 30, that sort of thing?
So as of September 26th, so 2 weeks from today, those between the ages of 18 and 69, those under the age of 70, will be able to book their appointments for the bivalent Omicron-targeted vaccine. For those who are younger than that age, they are eligible for a booster of the the monovalent, the previous vaccine that we've been using through the pandemic, and those individuals were encouraging to either finish their primary series of the vaccine, the first two doses, and then to get their booster as well.
All right, Mandy, we're concerned about back to school. Mind you, it's only been a week or so. So far, so good. I mean, are we seeing anything spiking?
So it's a little bit early to say with school just starting this past week, but we know that school is a place where definitely people are spending more time closer together and more time indoors than they might have through the summer months. And so just as in the rest of the community, those are situations that definitely are a bit higher risk, and definitely people should be thinking about what protections that they can take to best protect ourselves against COVID-19 and any other respiratory viruses that might be out there.
Ontario rolling out the Omicron-targeted COVID-19 vaccine to those 70 and older, and the rest coming very soon. Brendan Liu with us, Hamilton Public Services resident doctor, has been with us. Brendan, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Thank you. You too.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Over the course of the weekend, the Conservatives finally elected a new leader. It was a seven-month race. Pierre Poilievre is the new leader of the Conservative Party of Canada. To talk more about all of this, Michael Tope is with us, columnist for Troy Media and Loony Politics, contributor to the National Post and Washington Times, and was a speechwriter for former Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Michael, thank you for your time. I hope you're well.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott.
All right, so obviously no surprises here for the leader of the Conservative Party, but boy, there's a lot of people talking about it now, including the Prime Minister. The populism comments are out, and la 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 la, and the fear mongering. What are your thoughts the day or so after?
Well, a lot of yakety facts. I mean, I'm not surprised by this. You know, I'm not going to say I told you so. I've been saying this for months to you. I've been saying this for months for others. I've been going on radio shows over and over again since I endorsed Poilievre a couple days before he decided to run. As I've said multiple times, I did not know if he was going to run. I just thought that the conditions, political conditions, looked good for him. But he ran a brilliant campaign. It was extremely well run from start to finish. Couldn't have had a more well-oiled machine. I mean, it harkens back to the days of my old friend and boss, Stephen Harper, and even some of the older federal PC campaigns from way back when. It was just run really well, to the point that, and I said this before to you and others, Poilievre basically plucked things from all these different camps. He plucked from conservative supporters and voters, grassroots supporters, new Canadians, non-traditional supporters of the Conservative Party and conservative movement, appealing to them through sort of outside-the-box issues with, you know, affordable housing, cryptocurrency, et cetera, et cetera. He basically created a massive tent within the political tent. And, what he really also did was he used a general election strategy and brought it into a leadership campaign strategy, which usually the two are separate. Doesn't matter if we're talking about the Conservative Party, Liberals, NDP, Greens, whomever. Generally speaking, there's a way to run within the support base or to build new members or get new members, and you basically gear your messaging that way. You carry that over into a general election, but obviously you have to enhance it, include other groups, switch things around. Obviously, there's breaking news events and other things that pop in that have to be added to your campaign or your list of policies. What really Poilievre did that was so successful is he didn't listen to the nonsense. He canceled out the noise. He didn't let the media and others who were opposed to him bother him. He basically stayed focused, ran a small-c conservative message in many different ways, but plucked in and added in so many different components that it was basically unbeatable. And the numbers show it. 68.15% of all the points, you know, in the point system that the conservatives use to pick a new leader. Over 70% of the popular vote of conservative supporters. 330 of the 338 ridings in Canada, with obviously conservative support, went to Poilievre. Anyone who says the Conservative Party is not united now, Scott, it just shouldn't speak any longer. It is quite clear that they are all behind him.
Many said that the Liberal camp would rather were hoping to face Jean Charest, that would be a tougher battle for them. I'm not sure that's the case, especially when we're hearing what we're hearing today. So that being said, where is Jean Charest in any of this? Does he fit into the party? Does he fit into the plan? Or is that just, that's over and move on?
You know why they wanted to face Jean Charest, and this is no disrespect to Manuel. As I've said to you and others before, I've known him for many years. I like him as a person. He just wasn't suitable for political leader. They wanted him because they knew it would be an easier campaign against him. They weren't frightened of him. Frightened of the unknown, the unpredictable, and that's where Paul Lièvre's strength came from. Not that he's such a mysterious entity. You know, he's been in politics for nearly 20 years. People know him. But he's harder to go against because he has a lot of different messaging that he's using at the same time. But it's all going down the same road and just attracting an enormous swath of people and different groups and individuals from, you know, from coast to coast to coast. No, Jean Charest would have been much easier for them to go against, that being the Liberals, the NDP, and others, because he was a traditional type of politician. You knew where his strengths were, you knew where his weaknesses were, and unfortunately there were plenty in the latter category, and they would know how to fight against him. So no, that is the only reason they were pushing it. It's a media narrative and a political narrative working at the same time, because that's what they want to see. When papers like the Toronto Star are suggesting that Jean Charest is the better choice for the Conservative Party than Pierre Paul Lièvre, that raises the antennae of a lot of conservatives, because that's exactly what you don't want to see, with no disrespect to the Star.
So will the Prime Minister run again, or will he step out before the next election? And do you think that it's sooner rather than later?
Good question. I mean, the Toronto Star exclusive, actually from a week and a half ago, has suggested that he is going to stay. A lot of conservatives have suspected now for at least up to a month or more that this was a foregone conclusion for Paul Lièvre. It was just a question of by how many votes and how big he'd win on the first ballot. I'm sure that Trudeau knew to some degree, or people around him, his advisors knew. My guess is that he probably is telling the truth, that he is going to stick around. I think he'd like to win a fourth election. He'd be in very elite company in this country in terms of prime ministers of the past. I think he obviously wants to continue to build towards his legacy. I think he still in his own mind believes that he actually can win the next election. I think that he and his advisors feel that there are things about Paul Lièvre that they can attack pretty hard and that it will resonate with Canadians. But I think also privately behind the scenes, they know how difficult an opponent this is. They know how big a fight this is going to be. They know how good Paul Lièvre is at politics. You can say whatever you want about him. You can like him. You can hate him. He understands how to be a politician and how to work in politics, not from a traditional aspect, parts of it, yes, but from a modern aspect, whether it be visually, meaning people on the ground, messaging through videos. This is a guy who understands the day-to-day operations of politics in the modern sense, and that is very, very difficult to compete against. Even a prime minister who, yes, has been elected three times, no one's questioning that, but two of them, he actually finished second in the popular vote and has only received about a third of the support of Canadians who are eligible to vote in an election. Two-thirds of the country were looking for other options at that time, and while everyone's saying, oh, Pierre Paul Lièvre, he couldn't attract them, well, they also said the same thing, some of them, about the way he ran his leadership campaign, that it would all fizzle out. Well, it didn't.
Michael Tobe with us, Troy Media, Looney Politics commentator, also contributor to the National Post and Washington Times, and speechwriter for former Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Michael, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
My pleasure. You too.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
As we continue to watch the Queen and the 10 days of mourning that has already started, and King Charles, the Queen resting right now in Edinburgh, and a cathedral there where mourners are walking past. And it was just fascinating earlier to watch King Charles standing there and holding this vigil in front of the coffin while everybody walking by, and the lineups just absolutely incredible. Kenneth Lane is with us, Monarchist League of Canada, based in Victoria, BC. He is with us now. Kenneth, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Well, it's amazing. Each day brings a new revelation. We've had a commemorative display in our front yard for a while about the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, and we're now having neighbors dropping by to offer their condolences and indicate their support for the monarchy and the Queen.
Wow.
Never happened before. The neighbors have been haven't been that close or that conversational before.
That's fascinating. Tell everybody, give us a bit of an update on where we are in this 10 days of mourning and what's happening in Scotland now.
Well, I guess the most complicated scenario for the Queen's passing involved dying in Scotland. So there are certain rituals that the Scottish people insist upon for the passing of a monarch in their territory. So they had her in the palace for a while, which is the official, I guess, palace of the royalty in Scotland. And then she goes from there. They were going to put them on a train, put the Queen and her entourage on a train to London, the idea being it was a royal train going down the coast with a train following close behind because they anticipated a lot of flowers and things being thrown on the tracks that would need to be cleaned up. But they've decided not to do that, and they're just going to put the Queen on a plane and just fly her down to London. So they're making changes on the fly.
You talked about passing away in Scotland and how that has complicated things. We'd also heard that a lot of this has been planned out. How would this have changed things?
Well, if she died in London, for example, there would not have been the vigil, so to speak, in Scotland. Mm-hmm. Where men with were like Robin Hood archers in many ways in those kind of uniforms with arrows and feathers in their hats, you know, stand vigil over the Queen's body as their way of saying goodbye for a while. So that was a complicating factor. If she died abroad, it would have just flown her straight back into London. So Scotland was the complicating factor.
What is Scotland's reaction to this? Is it the same as the rest of the UK, or is it different considering their politics and past history?
Well, I think they're being very polite and very considerate, even though they are, there is a strong element that wishes not to have the British monarchy as the head of state. But they are being very polite, very considerate, which is not the same that can be said about other news outlets and other individuals on the social media. There's been incredibly nasty, unfeeling, hard-hearted comments, and the Scottish have scrupulously avoided that, and it's a credit to them.
Do you think that we'll immediately start having the debate whether the monarchy is still relevant? Is that for a place at a later time? Are you surprised people are chatting about that?
Well, those that are tend to be, all lobbying for the Republican form of government, they rarely miss an opportunity. So I'm not surprised that it hasn't emerged already. Where it's emerged the strongest seems to be in Australia. The anti-monarchy remnants down there make no bones, and they're not very nice about it. And even in the shadow of the Queen's passing, they're still not very nice about it.
Do you think this solidifies it in any way?
Well, I think it'll cause people some sober second thinking. I mean, there's a lot of, even in the Monarchist League here in Victoria, the branch here, the sentiment was very pro-Queen and somewhat anti-Charles. But, I think that sentiment is softening a bit. Charles has handled himself very well so far. And when they first sang God Save the King to him in the halls of House of Commons, wherever he was, he was very touched. He was very moved, very emotional, and he's really feeling it.
Kenneth Lane with us, Monarchist League of Canada, based out of Victoria, BC, talking about what we are watching with the Queen and the 10 days of mourning that has begun. Kenneth, thanks so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
All right, the mayoral race is heating up. Of course, municipal election coming up next month. Peter Grafe joining us, professor of political science at McMaster University. Talk about what they're all up to at this point. Peter, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
I am, thanks.
So Andrea Horvath announces a platform today, including a 10-year housing platform that includes eliminating the affordable housing waitlist through collaboration, increasing housing supply to bring down market costs, creating a dedicated department to streamline the building process. Recognition that housing is a basic human right and tackling homelessness. Your thoughts? A lot of this stuff sounds, well, they're all talking about building more houses. Can we make this happen, do you think?
I think all three main mayoral candidates are making promises around housing, but you know, the number of tools they actually hold to make it happen are a bit limited. I mean, there's some things around, planning and zoning where obviously they can make things better. Maybe Andrea Horvath has been the most specific of the candidates in terms of how she might sort of streamline the process within City Hall and to make it more transparent, but they're all kind of telling similar stories. There's just a limit. I mean, ultimately, you have to get either public money to build housing or to, encourage not-for-profits to build that housing, or you have to find ways to have private developers come in and build housing. So, the actual ability as a mayor is really going to be related a lot to what's happening in the decisions of the federal and provincial governments. And again, our different candidates have said that they are, going to create better relationships with those governments, but in most cases, they aren't actually going to be making decisions to help Hamilton. It's because it's going to serve the interests of Doug Ford or Justin Trudeau to be putting more money into that program Canada-wide, and probably more how it's going to play in places like Vancouver and Toronto. So, I mean, it's good that our candidates for mayor are concerned about housing because it's a concern of many Hamiltonians. But the solutions, to me, in my mind, look much the same, and a lot of their success will be related to the decisions of senior levels of government, and secondarily, whether local developers see it as profitable for them to be building the kinds of housing available to them.
Many have said the municipalities have been stumbling blocks, whether it's the NIMBYism of trying to fill an infill lot within the city limits, or it's environmentalists not wanting to expand the urban boundary. Many have said that this does lie at the hands of the municipalities. That being said, it's odd, as I said to you before, in the last provincial election, all four major political parties were talking about building a million homes. It's amazing how this is the focus now. That being said, how difficult is that at the city level with the municipalities and considering, well, and that's why we come up with a strong mayor's power thing out of Queen's Park for Toronto and Ottawa. That was to kind of hopefully break that logjam.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's, and we've seen in Hamilton, an unwillingness to explore things like laneway housing or, always putting limits on that. And, anyone actually promises to do anyone tries to develop some infill housing and there'll be, a street full of residents saying that this is, the sky is going to fall. And then, 5 years later, I go past that place and it just looks fine in the neighborhood and the sky hasn't fallen. But, the upside of this discussion is that there will be more pressure on the mayor to lead council. Part of the problem is, you're right, city councilors talk one game generally, but then when it's a street in their ward, they suddenly, are on the sides of those who don't want to have any kind of densification. And so, again, a mayor who's willing to actually, step forward and make the case and push the rest of the councillors to, stick to that position rather than, just always kowtowing the position of the local councillor because they kind of see it as a tit for tat, right? If they support the local councillor, then the other councillors will support them when they're trying to do that, and not much gets done. So, there is space for councils to do a lot better in terms of the planning process and having mayors that are pushing, for ways of removing that sort of that local break is useful in terms of if the point is just to get more units built.
In the Bob Bertina camp, getting the support of the transit union in Hamilton, saying earlier on last week, I believe, that with the LRT, that should be run by the HSR. Your thoughts on this endorsement?
Yeah, it's not surprising. I mean, Bob Bertina has been the candidate who's come out and said, the LRT, when it's there, should be run by, the ATU members. So it's pretty... tit for tat. What's of interest of the ATU is having to have those jobs and Bob to them too. Surprising. I mean, it's also similarly when Luna came out and supported Keenan Loomis earlier in this campaign. you know, again, I think there's similar views on the question of the LRT, you know, explained, you know, why they did that. They saw Keenan Loomis as the LRT candidate. And, you know, there's a lot of jobs for the boys when you're building a huge system like that. So, you know, again, I think we're seeing unions taking pretty logical positions in terms of deciding where their bread is buttered.
Keenan Loomis spouting change, a different direction in transparency and such. How does he make noise? How does he make hay amongst these other higher profile candidates who are getting some pretty big endorsements?
Well, I think he really has to find a way of making this a campaign, you know, about issues, I guess. You know, that's what he's been running on. He has, a particular platform. And he's running against two candidates who are really running on name recognition. And so, yeah, I mean, he does have to find a way of waking up the campaign and developing some real points of difference between himself and those candidates. I think to date we've seen with the platforms that Bob Bertina and Andrea Horvath has come out, they've made, the life difficult for him. Because while he has a number of, you know, promises that look a bit different than theirs, overall they're all, I think, dancing in pretty much a similar space. And so for, you know, voters who are really interested in the issues, they're probably, you know, making pretty fine-grained changes or decisions between them. I mean, the other opportunity for Keenan Loomis is to say, well, this is a change election and we have two, you know, longtime politicos that he's running up against. And, you know, he might be able to move in that manner. But I think it would be a lot easier for him if he had a greater degree of name recognition within the cities so that he could really leverage that difference. I think to date, particularly when you're the Chamber of Commerce, a former Chamber of Commerce president, you're not necessarily seen as someone who's really that out of step with the way things have been done in the city over the past 25 years.
Peter Greif with us, professor of political science, McMaster University, talking about Hamilton's mayoral race. Peter, as always, thank you for the time. Be well.
And you too.
Following just a tragic story today, of which there's still limited information available, but a suspect is in custody after a shooting in Mississauga and another one in Milton that left two people dead and three people injured. The first incident was reported in Mississauga, where police said one person was killed and another taken to a local trauma center. Multiple sources have told Global News the victim of the fatal shooting in Mississauga was a Toronto police officer. To give us an update from Global News, Matt Carty, reporter, is with us now. Matt, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well. What's the latest on all of this? It seems to be a very fluid situation.
Yeah, very, very fluid and very chaotic through all that the afternoon. We don't have all the information. We really don't have the timeline down, but you kind of went through it there. 2 o'clock this afternoon, there was a shooting in Mississauga in the area of Argentia and Winston Churchill. We were told this was in a plaza with Tim Hortons, a Walmart, various other shops in this plaza as well. Also a very busy time of the day in broad daylight. And as you mentioned, sources telling Global News that a police officer out of Toronto was shot and killed. Another person was also transported to a trauma center. Now, what a Toronto police officer was doing in Mississauga at the time, we don't know. We don't know if he was on duty or is she. We're unclear of the gender of this individual as well, but whether they were on duty or off duty, still really unclear about those sort of details in Mississauga. Then at around 3:30, Halton police announcing a shooting in Milton near Bronte and King. You're hearing the scene that one might be some sort of auto body shop, but again, that is unconfirmed. We know from that scene one person was pronounced dead and at least two wounded. So we have two dead, including one police officer, three injured so far. Very preliminary information that we're gathering right now. We're not sure if any of the other fatalities or the other three injured are police officers or civilians. We also got that emergency alert that was sent to cell phones warning people of a suspect armed and dangerous in a black Jeep Grand Cherokee stolen. There's also a photo of the suspect quickly posted by Peel Regional Police. And then just after 4:30, Halton Police announcing that the suspect had been located and is now in police custody. The very latest is we know there is a police scene in Hamilton on a stretch of road off the 403 beside a cemetery that is completely blocked off. It's unclear if this is connected to the shootings. One of our colleagues, of course, is trying to get to that scene to take a look and ask some questions. And we know there is a police news conference coming up in about 5 minutes from Hamilton Police from the scene. So we're sure to get information on what exactly is going on there. So like I said, very chaotic afternoon, very fluid, spanning several cities, affecting several police forces. Way too early to talk about any kind of motive. Like I said, all very early right now.
Can you once again expand on the situation in Hamilton? Is this just coincidence? No idea if that is related at this point.
No idea if it is related at this point. We do know that police blocked off a stretch of road there. I believe it's York Road. You might know better than me. And there's a cemetery there. It's off the 403. We know there's a scene there. There's an active scene there right now. But again, police won't say if this is confirmed to any of the shootings that happened in Milton and Mississauga. We do have a police news conference coming up in about 5 minutes to clear some of the things up about what's going on there. And to see if this is all connected. But as of right now, unclear if the situation in Hamilton is connected to the shootings in Milton and Mississauga.
When this started all in Mississauga, you were talking about it being in a shopping area, in a crowded area and such. Any idea what that was about, what caused that? Was it a domestic type situation, a robbery situation? Any idea?
Yeah, really unclear about what happened in Mississauga to perhaps start all this off. It's really unclear if this started in Mississauga. This may have started in Milton. I mean, Halton police only announced at 3:30 that there had been a shooting. I don't believe they posted a time of when that shooting happened. We do know Peel police said the shooting in Mississauga happened at 2:00. So again, I mentioned earlier there, the timeline is still kind of really all over the place, and we're still trying to firm up those details. And to your point there, we don't know what the motive is. We don't know what started all of this. There's so many questions that still need to be answered. We might not even get all the answers from police. Now that a police officer, our source is telling us, has been shot and killed, this could be a matter for the SIU. They may take over the whole aspect of this investigation. And with the SIU, it could be months before we find out exactly what happened when they released that final report.
Do we know anything on the other victims, anybody who has been shot or injured, or is there only the one police officer involved that we know of?
Yeah, so far we only know of the one police officer out of Toronto who was shot and killed in the Mississauga location, Argentia and Winston Churchill, in a very busy plaza. We know one other person there was transported to a trauma center. And then with the Milton location, we know that at least one person is dead, and at least two others are injured. And again, we don't know if any of the other injuries or that other fatality in Milton are police officers or they're civilians. Again, so much information. It's spanning so many jurisdictions too, right? So we have a Toronto police officer dead. We have a shooting with Peel police. We have a shooting with Milton police. And we might find out in a few minutes if Hamilton police are involved or any other police services in sort of that GTHA area. I mean, this individual was likely on highways if he was going from Milton to Mississauga. Perhaps the OPP is involved as well. Again, there's a lot of information coming from so many different sources right now, and trying to firm all that up is what we're going to be doing over the next hours and even days and into the week.
And just to clarify here, Matt, we do not know if that police officer who was obviously in Mississauga, Toronto police officer, the Mississauga is obviously Peel. We don't know if he was on duty or what that situation was.
Right. We have no idea what took that police officer out of Toronto. And again, no idea if this officer was on duty or off duty. That still remains to be seen. But again, more information coming minute by minute. And as the hours go, we'll just continue to find out more information, flesh out what is true and flesh out what is not true, and deliver the facts.
What do we know about the suspect being arrested? What happened there?
Again, we're not sure. Halton police announced that just after 4:30 that he was taken into custody. Really unclear where that happened. We also know from the Milton area that one person was dead. And it's just, you know, the news cycle in the 21st century, a lot of this coming through Twitter, trying to call media relations is a bit of a challenge with all the calls I'm sure they're taking every minute from every news outlet. We're getting calls into our newsroom from affiliates out in Vancouver and Edmonton and Calgary wanting to know what's going on as well. And it's just very limited information. I mean, this only started a few hours ago. And as we go along here, we're just going to continue to find out more and more information about what exactly happened, what led up to this, what are the motives, and maybe get a firm up count about who was shot, who was injured, who are these people, and just continue to find out more and more as we go.
Matt Carty with us, reporter for Global News. Make sure you're watching Global Tonight for more on all of this, and a news conference is upcoming. Matt, thanks for the time. Be well.
Yes, you too. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
But this doesn't mean that we're not going to be calling out highly questionable, reckless economic ideas, buzzwords, dog whistles, and careless attacks. Don't add up to a plan for Canadians. Attacking the institutions that make our society fair, safe, and free is not responsible leadership.
Oh, did you see he used the word free? Sounds scared, doesn't he? To the extremist, divisive, populist leader on the left, meet the extremist, divisive, populist leader on the right. Because you both cut from the same cloth, just from different points on the political spectrum. But it's all the same. Scott Radley with us, host of The Scott Radley Show, coming up right after the 6 o'clock news. And you can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He's with us now. Scott, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm well, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Your thoughts on Pierre Poilievre getting getting the nod? I guess there's no surprise there. I think this is going to be a very interesting time.
Let's say this, regardless of which side the aisle you're on now, some of the comments from the prime minister there, there is plenty
dog
of
whistle
fodder.
Buzzwords. Well, my goodness. Okay. He's the king.
I have a problem with that particular word that the prime minister used there. Dog whistle traditionally, more recently, is used, at least I've only ever heard it used, in a racist context. These are dog whistle words. It's used to define generally someone who is saying something that is racist or something that's, like that. If you're going to say that, and I'm sure that they will call out Pierre Poilievre and say that you've got to be clear on that word. That to me is a loaded word. The rest of it, to me, it's all fair game. And you're going to hear a ton of this going back and forth. Because you know what? You're going to hear them say, well, look, as you did, the prime minister is going to say, look, he's got catchphrases and he's divisive and all the rest, and he doesn't have real solutions. And you're going to hear Pierre Poilievre point out, well, this is the prime minister who says he doesn't think about economics and the budget will balance itself. And we are now, if we weren't before, I really believe we are now in the, okay, let's choose which side of the fence you're on here. And there's really not going to be much in the middle. And you would think to yourself, oh, well, then maybe there is a party that could slip into the middle and attract some people who really, but the NDP seem to be determined to be even further left of the Liberals. So that middle ground now is a chasm. It's a chasm for people, and you're going to have to choose.
It's amazing, though, how each side talks about how extreme the other side is. You know, that just amazes me to no end, because, again, they're both extremists. How can you sit and say what you say about Poilievre, meaning to the prime minister, about dog whistles and whatever and populist politics, when he's gone so far left that he's teamed up with the NDP? So, when the politics goes far left, you're going to see the opposition go far right. When the politics goes far right, you're going to see the opposition go far left. So how can one not blame the other for where we are? Because they're both extremists.
Let me throw another question at you there. And some people will snort when I say this and laugh, but I'm going to say it sincerely. Is Poilievre far right? Or has the center, where the Liberals claim to be, moved so far to the left that now if you look more towards the center, it looks like you're way to the right of where that target is. You understand what I'm saying? If the line moves,
absolutely.
So I'm not suggesting that Polyev is not on the right. I don't mean that for a second. But I also think that some of these suggestions that, you know, he is, you know, pushing fascism and all this. No, I really think that we as a country have nudged our way left and left and left and left. So anything to the right seems like it's way to the right now. But really, is it really wildly right wing to say we want to be economically responsible and not spend and spend and spend and go way into debt? I'm not sure that that's a extreme right-wing position. I think 50 years ago that would have been seen as a very centrist position, but now it's an extreme right position.
The liberals have gone from very, very fashionable to unfashionable, and I mean, let's, as you just mentioned,
that happens with every party as they
absolutely
for a long time.
Absolutely. And you know, as you mentioned, other than healthcare, the top five issues are economic, whether it's housing, whether it's groceries, inflation, whether it's the price of energy, the price of fuel. And that's just not the wheelhouse for the liberals. It's sunny ways and nice socks and such when and saving the world as opposed to managing things.
So, you have a party that's been in there for a long time. And as you say, you've got a party that now has, as happens with everybody, this is, again, not picking on the liberals, any party that it governs for a while now has warts.
Best before date.
People have seen what's happened. And like we were talking about this on my show last week. I don't claim to predict things correctly all that often or to say that I was bang on. There's one thing I said, though, a while back, and I still am going to stick to it, and you've touched on it here. It's economic. I said a long time ago that it was with Aaron O'Toole. Forget, don't get dragged into all the peripheral stuff that your opponents are going to try and argue about you. Don't try and get into another abortion debate, because that's not really going
populist
to be an issue.
Politics.
If you want to win, set yourself up as the party of the proper, mature adult handling of the economy. Leave the other skirmishes alone, because you're not going to get anywhere with those. And when the next election comes around, if you have established that we're the ones who will take the economy seriously, we're the ones who are not playing around with it, we're the ones who understand your issues, I think you are put into a far better position if, and we thought this might happen, and it is, if things are getting tougher and tougher and tougher. And you know what? If you can't put food on your table, and if you can't put a roof over your head, and if you can't do this and do that, all those other things become secondary. You care about the economy and the finances. That should be, and it is really, Pierre Polyev should ignore all the other stuff. Talk about the economy, force the liberals to defend their economic position. That's going to be a winner. All the other stuff just drags you into the weeds.
Scott Radley, host of the Scott Radley Show, coming up after the 6 o'clock news. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Scott, have a great show. Thanks for the time.
Hey, can I make one quick plug?
Yes.
We have coming up on the show, Andrea Horvath put out her platform today. She is joining us after the show for a couple segments to talk about it. And then 2 weeks from now, we have Keenan Loomis doing the same. And on October the 3rd, so Mayoral Mondays, Bob Bertina joins us for his. So
beautiful.
Three of the next four Mondays. Tune in for sure if you don't already.
Going to be fascinating to talk about that housing issue, because it's either environmentalists on the one side who don't want the urban expansion, boundary
left
expansion,
or
the inner city kids with NIMBYism. I mean, how do you get her done here? Scott,
same
coming up next.
We're just talking about. Yep.
Have fun, dude. Thanks for the time.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, greatly appreciated. Thanks to the two Wills and Diana and Dave in the newsroom. As always, we leave it to you, the tax-paying customer, to have the last word.
Roy wrote in to say, Scott, 5 years ago, a friend reported several coyotes in the area here. They did nothing. Now it's a real problem. Maybe they need to hire the Roadrunner. If he catches you, you're through. Beep, beep. Back when cartoons were funny.
That's what they need.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.